This is The Takeaway for Monday, July 10th, 2017.
Hey, happy birthday, Alex.
Happy birthday, Isabel. Isabel, you know what I want for my birthday?
Oh, what do you want, Alex?
I would like you to go to iTunes and download The Takeaway podcast and leave us a review.
And how about a rating, too?
Let's do it.
Okay.
Iraqi civilians and soldiers danced on the street.
The people in Mosul are celebrating the recent victories.
There's been little to cheer here for so long that soldiers and civilians took to the streets to celebrate.
A milestone in Iraq where U.S.-backed Iraqi forces are declaring victory over ISIS in Mosul.
Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi
congratulated the Iraqi forces and the people on the victory and declared the city liberated.
After months of hiding, many used by ISIL as human shields, terrified civilians emerged from the rubble.
My God, ISIL didn't let us out. There were snipers shooting at us.
Mosul is Iraq's biggest metropolis outside of Baghdad.
Second largest city.
And gaining control of the city was one of ISIS's most significant strategic wins.
Iraqi forces continued to shepherd civilians out of the old city.
The level of destruction in the old city is almost total.
It will take 2 months to restore basic services such as electricity and water.
Virtually every single building is either completely or partially reduced to rubble.
Many will carry the scars of this battle for the rest of their lives.
Victory for Iraqi forces over ISIS in Mosul and a long, long way to go. I'm Todd Zwillick and this is The Takeaway. You heard there the celebrations and the elation as Iraqi forces finally drove ISIS out of Mosul. It's a city the Islamic State has held for more than 3 years. Behind the joy, though, is devastation. Nearly a million Iraqis were displaced by the invasion and the fighting, and thousands died. On Sunday, Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi arrived in Mosul, dressed in battle fatigues, to celebrate the army's victory. It's a major defeat for ISIS, but now it only gives way to concerns about what's next, as the brutal and violent movement is backed into a corner. Tim Arango is the Baghdad bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times. He's been following the story closely. He's been in Mosul twice since the weekend. Tim, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be with you.
What do things look like on the ground in the city of Mosul now?
Well, it's really two cities right now. There's the east side of the city on the east bank of the Tigris, and that's pretty normal. That was liberated in January. But then you go to the other side in the west where there's actually still some fighting remaining, and it's just absolutely devastated, particularly in the old city. You just can't imagine the apocalyptic nature of the devastation. Most buildings in the old city are flattened. There's still bodies everywhere. The stench is in the air. It's just really a devastating scene. And, you know, American commanders have said this was the worst urban combat since World War II, and it really looks like that in Mosul's old city.
This took a very long time for Iraqi forces backed by the United States and others to get into Mosul and to retake it. ISIS held this second largest city in the country for 3 years. That's an awful long time. Why did it take so long for forces to get mobilized, to get ISIS out?
Yeah, when Islamic State took over Mosul in 2014, the Iraqi security forces just fled and ISIS took the city in a matter of days. And so that brought the U.S. back to try to rebuild the Iraqi security forces. And it was a very long effort until they were ready last October to start this operation. And when it started in October, I think there was some optimism that there would be an uprising among the civilians and that it could go quickly. But of course, the opposite happened, and Islamic State was very much dug in. And it took 9 months of brutal fighting to do this.
Tim Arango, let's step back a little bit. What is the state of ISIS now? Of course, we know they've lost geographic territory. They've lost some footing in cities. Does that really make much of a difference in terms of their operations? What's the condition of the Islamic State?
Well, certainly their state building project is on the wane. They've lost Mosul. They're probably going to lose Raqqa and Syria in the next few months. There's still some cities they control in Iraq, but they're much smaller than Mosul. But what we're seeing is that they still have the ability to inspire attacks abroad. But for Iraqis, they're terrified of what's next in terms of the group becoming a very potent insurgency like it has been almost since the immediate aftermath of the 2003 invasion. And so they'll go back to their, you know, sort of their roots as an insurgency. And there's no doubt they're going to continue to carrying out attacks, suicide attacks and car bomb attacks in places like Baghdad and other cities. So by no means does this mean that Iraq is going to become a peaceful place.
People will remember concerns from commanders during the Iraq War that the Sunni extremists who are the predecessors of ISIS would just melt into the population and engage in the type of insurgent terrorism that you're talking about. It's exactly what happened. I mean, this part of the play has run before.
Yeah, we've seen it before. And the one consistent thing people were telling me in my visits to Mosul from coming from the mouths of some of the commanders is they believe so many of these guys, especially the Iraqi fighters, just shaved their beards and melted into the civilian population who was fleeing the battles and are probably now living in the many refugee camps around Mosul.
Is there still an idea, Tim, in Iraq that ISIS can be defeated militarily? Is anyone talking about the eventual need for a political settlement, as they so often do in cases like this?
People talk about it. That's one consistent message from lots of people, that always the military gains come without any political reconciliation. And so then, you know, time passes and then we're back doing this. There's discussions of it, but there's been no meaningful reconciliation. And if anything, the Sunni community is more devastated than ever without any effective leadership. It's civilians are, you know, millions of them are displaced and the cities are in ruins. And so there's been very little talk of any meaningful political bargain to sort of end this for good.
You mentioned earlier in our conversation, Tim, that one of the questions at stake here is whether Iraq can stay together. Fighting ISIS has, of course, been at least some form of unifying force among at least some of the major groups in Iraq. What's the concern now if this fight winds down, or at least becomes less of a direct military engagement, about Iraq's ability to continue on as a country?
Yeah, I think that's right. The fight against ISIS brought a lot of groups together who are normally at odds with each other: the Kurds, the Shia militias, the Iraqi government. The most immediate event that will happen is in September, the Iraqi Kurds are planning a referendum on independence. They've been moving in that direction for a very, very long time, and it seems inevitable. The referendum will pass because most Kurds want their own country. It won't mean independence immediately or even a declaration of independence, but it'll be a big moment setting that on its course.
Well, let's just go back to Mosul for a moment before we let you go, Tim. You mentioned the devastation in that city, that everything west of the river is mostly rubble. Thousands of people have been killed, up to 1 million people displaced. Is there any idea when people might be able to begin to return to their homes? Is that even something that's conceivable now?
Well, in the east, it's like a different city. So people have returned there from that battle. In the west, particularly in the old city, no one knows. It could be a very, very long time because it's just not livable. And so the big question is, how soon can they restore services? Where can they get the money from the Iraqi government or from regional countries or the international community to start rebuilding? But those are questions that no one can quite answer at this moment.
Tim Arango, Baghdad Bureau Chief for our partner, The New York Times. Thank you so much, Tim.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
This is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. President Trump is back from his G20 meeting in Germany. And his final message before leaving, despite election interference, it's time to move forward in working constructively with Russia. The president says he raised it in a more than 2-hour meeting with Vladimir Putin. Vladimir Putin denied election interference, and then Putin told reporters the president accepted that denial. What is U.S. policy toward Russia now? President Trump said it's time to move on, and that he and Vladimir Putin talked about what the president called an impenetrable cybersecurity unit so that election hacking and many other negative things will be guarded. And then the reaction to that came from all over Washington. Inviting Russia to cooperate on cybersecurity was like cooperating with ISIS on counterterrorism, like cooperating with a fox on henhouse security. Senator Marco Rubio of Florida said it was like forming an anti-chemical weapons unit with Assad's Syria. And Lindsey Graham went on Meet the Press.
It's not the dumbest idea I've ever heard, but it's pretty close. He gave a really good speech in Poland, President Trump did, and he had what I think is a disastrous meeting with President Putin. 2 hours and 15 minutes of meetings Tillerson and Trump are ready to forgive and forget when it comes to cyber attacks on the American election of 2016.
By last night, the president seems to have gotten the message. He said on Twitter, "The fact that President Putin and I discussed cybersecurity unit doesn't mean I think it can happen. It can't, but a ceasefire can and did." We're going to talk about the president's meeting with Vladimir Putin, what he might have gotten out of the Russians, and also about this apparent ceasefire in Syria that the president's talking about. Will Pomerantz is deputy director of the Kennan Institute for Advanced Russian Studies at the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. from 1992 to 1999. He served as program officer for Russia at the National Endowment for Democracy. Will, welcome to The Takeaway.
My pleasure to be here.
President Trump says he did not discuss sanctions with Vladimir Putin. The Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, says they did discuss it. It's a little bit bewildering, but what did we learn about the U.S.-Russia relationship after this meeting between the two leaders?
Well, let's focus on that issue of sanctions first, because Secretary of State Tillerson has now emphasized after the meeting that there will be no change in the U.S. sanctions policy until there is some resolution of the situation in Ukraine. So it's unclear to what extent Putin objected to the sanctions. He always does. He has done so virtually everywhere he's gone around the world. But it appears that the U.S. at least is going to keep its current sanctions regime in place.
That being the case on sanctions, what does the Trump administration's current position on Russian meddling in the 2016 election seem to be?
Well, again, we can rely on President Trump's words the day before his meeting with President Putin, where he said it might be Russia, but it could have been someone else as well. So I think from the President Trump's perspective, he is continuing to try to portray that it may have been Russia, but it was not exclusively Russia. And obviously that has political consequences back home, because Congress, as your statements highlighted, wants to still address this question of Russian interference in the U.S. elections, and they're not willing to forgive and forget. And they're not willing to move forward without actually understanding what Russia did and imposing some sort of penalty on Russia to make sure that it doesn't happen again. So for Donald Trump and his Russia policy, it is clearly constrained by domestic political considerations, because whereas he wants to move forward, it appears that Congress, and there's still an investigation out there as well, does not necessarily want to move forward.
Right. And hovering behind all of this, of course, you mentioned the investigations into Russian meddling in the U.S. election, possible collusion investigations both in Congress and from the Justice Department with the special counsel. News over the weekend, Will Pomerantz, that the son of President Trump, Donald Trump Jr., now acknowledges that he met with a Russian lawyer during the campaign and met with that lawyer on the promise that that person had damaging information about Hillary Clinton. At first, this meeting was not disclosed. Apparently, Jared Kushner was there, the campaign manager. Paul Manafort was there. Put this news in the context of what we already know about interactions between the Trump campaign and Russians.
It just shows that despite all their denials, there seems to be this steady stream of meetings. And in this particular case, it appears to have been a meeting to find out various dirt about the Clinton campaign and potential Russian support of the Clinton campaign. So what I think it emphasizes is that a whole variety of people associated with the Trump campaign and family consistently have these meetings with Russians, don't disclose them, and then they come out drip by drip. So what it essentially means is that as much as Donald Trump tries to put this story behind him, we continue to have new revelations that keeps this story going. And in most instances, it's related to the Trump and the Trump campaign itself.
And the story repeated another pattern. It stepped on some positive developments that President Trump seems to have brought out of his meeting with Vladimir Putin. A de-escalation plan and an apparent ceasefire in southern Syria. What do we know about the plan and whether this one is likely to hold better than other ceasefire plans have in that war?
Well, this plan appears, Trump tried to make it appear that this kind of came out of the meeting, but clearly this has been negotiated for quite a while, especially because Jordan was evidently a part of this agreement as well. And it's an attempt to de-escalate the conflict in one part of Syria, in southwest Syria. And so far, for the last 24 hours, it appears to be holding. but there have been numerous types of agreements like this in the past, and they have not held. And in many ways, while it is a positive development in terms of that particular region, it doesn't address the U.S. concerns about President Assad and the fact that President Putin is the person responsible for making sure that President Assad stays in power. So there's still just a long way to go in terms of what the future of Syria looks like, how it's going to be negotiated amongst the parties, and really whether this is a step towards a larger peace process or this is just a particular agreement to deal with a particular region at this time.
A fragile agreement in southern Syria with an uncertain future between President Trump, Vladimir Putin, and other actors around the Syria war. News that got occluded by potential collusion discussions between Trump relatives and Russians. Will Pomerantz, Deputy Director for the Kennan Institute for the Advanced Russian Studies at the Wilson Center. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. For the second year in a row, South Sudan has passed its Independence Day with no festivities and little to celebrate. Civil war and famine led President Salva Kiir Mayardit to cancel celebrations for the country's sixth anniversary of independence. South Sudan gained independence from Sudan in 2011 and has been in a civil war with internal factions since 2013. 300,000 people have died since then, with 3.5 million more displaced in a country of just 12 million people. And as farmers flee their fields and inflation soars, 6 million people now face the prospect of starvation. Alan Boswell is a conflict researcher and writer based in Nairobi. He's been covering South Sudan.
The country isn't in much of a partying mood, so holding the Independence Day celebrations really wouldn't have looked very good to all the people in the country who are displaced and who are basically relying on food aid right now if they can even get it to eat. So, and this isn't the first year they canceled it either. The official explanation for it is that the government doesn't have the money to hold the Independence Day celebration. That's partly true. The government is in a very dire financial situation. However, it's still managing to fight war across the country. So if the money is there for government offensives, then theoretically they probably could have found some for the Independence Day celebration as well. And all throughout, the South Sudanese people are quite in despair about what has happened to their nation. And really, the country just keeps fragmenting politically and increasingly on ethnic lines. And there's no really quick, easy solution for putting it back together.
There may not be. At the same time, the United States, of course, was instrumental in helping South Sudan form as an independent nation when it broke off. Where is the U.S. now, and how are South Sudanese viewing the U.S. role as their country disintegrates?
Yeah, the U.S. role is often not played up enough, I think, in the media coverage of the crisis. South Sudanese will tell you, as will anyone who's kind of looked into the issue seriously, that South Sudan would not be a state if it were not for the United States. It was really the U.S. diplomatic effort, especially under George W. Bush, that really pushed the framework of the peace deal that led to South Sudan's independence. And then it was really the U.S. that really kind of made sure that went forward. So when you go around, you know, in South Sudan, you still often are asked as an American, like, hey, can the U.S. come in and help fix this? And what's your plan? And of course, there is no easy fix and there is no plan. And, you know, South Sudanese coming to that realization is also, it makes them despair a little bit in that sense, too. The Trump administration has not appointed a special envoy. The last special envoy left when the Obama administration ended. There's also yet to be an appointment for the Assistant Secretary of State for Africa. So specifically in the case of South Sudan, the Obama administration's policy had completely failed by the time of independence. So in the midst of all this crisis, you have the U.S., who has been the leading actor on South Sudan for more than a decade, and really no one is capable, willing, or no one wants to take the lead on this issue.
And it's a shocking answer when, as we said, up to 6 million people are at risk of starvation there. Alan Boswell, before we let you go, we've reported on this show in recent weeks on efforts from UN envoys and others to get donor countries to pledge and to give funds for South Sudan and other countries facing famine. Is there a sense of apathy in Europe and the United States and other donor countries, Saudi Arabia, that are usually relied on to give in situations like this?
You know, I think with all the things facing the world right now, it's hard to keep hitting the drumbeat on the famine. I suspect the other issue that probably hurts the, you know, amount of relief coming in is that it's kind of been widely accepted now, which is true, that famines are pretty much all man-made crises. But when you phrase it that way, I think it probably, while it's true, I imagine it also makes the outcry have a bit less zeal to it when you know it's not the cause of just drought or just poverty, but is of course related to much deeper political problems that food aid doesn't really solve.
A world slow to act and to react as South Sudan faces devastating famine, millions at risk of starvation. Alan Boswell, conflict researcher and journalist, joining us from Nairobi. Alan, thank you.
Thank you.
The ratcheting down on immigration enforcement from the Trump administration is having an effect on industries that rely on temporary foreign workers. Increased raids have caused some workers, both legal and undocumented, to stay away, and proponents of tough immigration laws say that's part of the point. But now, farmers in California's Central Valley who rely on those workers for affordable planting and harvests say they sometimes don't have enough hands to get their crops in. Joe Del Bosque is president of Del Bosque Farms in Fireball, California, and Joe began noticing a trend about a decade ago.
It's been getting a little worse all the time, such that we have, in a few cases, lost a little bit of our crop because we don't have enough crews to cover the harvest. Sometimes at the beginning of the season, when we're expecting our crews to show up, which is generally about the 1st of July, if they don't show up in time, sometimes we don't have enough crews to cover the ground. And our crop, which is melons, is highly perishable. So if we're not able to cover the fields, sometimes we leave some fruit behind that is lost.
And Joe, where are these crews coming from? You said they come from Arizona, they come from other states. But how do you come by the labor? Do you go through a broker? How do you get them?
We have been shifting over the last 10 years to use more and more local labor, but we still have a certain pool that we get that comes from Mexico. They come from Mexico into Arizona, and then they come to us.
And what percentage of your workers would you say fit that category who come from Mexico?
Probably 30 to 35%. There's probably six or seven cantaloupe companies, and they all use about 300 people. And then there's tomato companies that need a lot, hundreds of people. And then you got garlic and grapes. There's just not enough people right here in this area. And we can't get people to come from the cities, like say San Jose, that's an hour and a half away. We can't get them to come out here to work on the farm.
So Joe, to be clear, are we talking strictly about legal immigrants who come to work on farms like yours? Do you check everyone? Do you have anyone working in your fields who's either undocumented or you don't know their status?
Everybody is required to provide us with an I-9. And the I-9 has to be filled out showing some form of identification that shows that they're authorized to work.
Agriculture has been a huge part of the immigration debate. It's been going on for years. A lot of farmers like you and produce companies have lobbied and warned that they need access to labor and, frankly, to inexpensive labor to keep food prices low, and that temporary immigration provides that labor. Of course, there are millions of people here illegally at the same time. So from your perspective, trying to do business and get those cantaloupes in from the fields, what needs to happen with immigration from your point of view?
I believe that there has to be two things. One is I think those that are here today and working would like to have legal status. We would like them to have legal status. They would like to have legal status. Now, those that come from across the border, I think we need to have a guest worker program because our labor pool, as we have it today, every year a few, maybe 5% or so retire. And we need to have replacements. The folks that we have living here now and working for us, their children are not going to come work for us. They're going to go to school. They want to do just like any American young person, go to college, seek their American dream.
Joe, do you feel like the politicians who are having this years-long debate over immigration are hearing you on this?
Oh, yes. I think they're hearing us. But you know, there's factors that are against this. I think there's groups out there that don't want these immigrants to settle here. There's groups that don't want them to come in and take these jobs, even though the jobs are really jobs that a lot of Americans don't want. There's always been opposition to these plans, and we just can't get Congress to get together and pass a comprehensive bill that will cover at least those two things.
A view on immigration and labor from the farm with Joe Del Bosque. Joe, thank you.
Thank you.
Joe Del Bosque is president of Del Bosque Farms in Firebaugh, California. There's a national debate over raising the minimum wage, but while there's been very little movement in Congress recently, dozens of cities have gone ahead and raised their local minimum wages on their own. In 2015 in St. Louis, the former mayor, Francis Slay, signed a bill to raise the city's minimum wage from $7.70 an hour to $11 by 2018.
Hard work should be rewarded. Mothers and fathers who put in an honest day's work and play by the rules should be able to make ends meet for them and their families. $7.60 an hour, that's less than $16,000 a year for somebody working full time. That isn't good enough for a nation that prides itself on being the land of opportunity.
That was in 2015, but then the GOP-controlled legislature in Missouri immediately moved to block that increase. The fight went to court, and the minimum wage in St. Louis went up to $10 per hour. That's about $400 a month for a full-time worker. But now, Missouri Republican Governor Eric Greitens says he'll allow a bill passed by the state legislature to become law, making it illegal for any city in Missouri to raise its minimum wage past the state's $7.70 per hour. And that means that at the end of the summer, workers across St. Louis will have to say goodbye to their newly increased wages. Betty Douglas works for a McDonald's in St. Louis, and she's joined the Fight for 15 movement for better pay. Betty, welcome.
Well, thank you.
And how did your life change when your pay went from $7.90 to $10 an hour?
Much better. It gave me an extra $400 a month, whereas I was getting my gas cut off, my electric cut off, water, juggling bills, eating. I have a 16-year-old son. So the $400 a month, it helped me tremendously.
Now, has your employer said that your pay will go back down to $7.90? Has that been discussed at work? What'll happen at the end of the summer?
No, it has not. He made a little comment when we first got the $10. So he's so sure that, you know, we're not going to keep the $10.
Betty, what about health care? I wonder what you do for health insurance or if Medicaid is available to you or how you pay for health care.
You know, I haven't seen a doctor since I had my last child in that 16 years because I have no insurance. I have none at all. I've got a toothache that I need to go to the dentist, like yesterday. I don't have any insurance, so I can't see a doctor. And like with the pain, I have to get me an Advil or some type of aspirin or something and weigh it out. I haven't eaten for 24 hours because I had a toothache, and I don't have groceries, really. So I'm just going to be honest and put it out there.
Betty, someone listening to you might think, you know, $400 per month is great, but you got by before on $7.90. You could get by again on $7.90 if that's what the legislature and the government says. What do you think might happen to you and your family if you go back down to $7.90?
Well, just let me make a comment on that because it's easy for someone else to say that, but you need to walk in my shoes, okay, and make it $7.90 an hour for 10 years on a job, trying to maintain a family, a home. I'm very stressed out. I've been very stressed out. It's very hard not making a livable wage, having bill collectors calling you on your job or garnishments on your check. And I went a whole winter without gas. So saying that, it's very hard. It's very hard. And my family, they suffer a lot. And I do too. Sometimes I don't even eat because I have to make sure that I have a 16-year-old son. He's 6'6". And every time I see him, he's leaving the kitchen. He's eating all the time. I can't say, well, sure. You know, yeah, I can't say, don't eat this, don't eat that, because we got to eat the rest of the week or whatever. And I just think that, you know, these politicians, And whoever it feels like, well, you made it then, you'll be able to make it again. But it was a struggle. And no one that lives in America should have to struggle the way that I have to. I work hard. I don't miss days for work. I can't afford to. Milk's going up. Groceries going up. Utilities, they're going up. Everything's going up with our paychecks. And it's just not, it's not fair. So it's always easy for someone else that's making like our CEO with McDonald's. They're making like millions of bucks. But, you know, I can't even feed my family. Who can live off of $7.90? Who?
Betty Douglas, good luck to you.
Thank you.
Betty Douglas works at McDonald's in St. Louis. Have you ever made your state's minimum wage? Could you live off it?
This is Jen from Texas. I have worked at minimum wage jobs for most of my adult life. I could only afford to rent one bedroom in a cheap house or apartment with roommates and eat mostly ramen noodles and other discount foods. Saving money wasn't possible, and a medical emergency made me homeless. I made the hard choice to go into debt in order to go to college in the hopes that I could get a job that makes supporting myself actually possible.
Hi, this is Bruce from Long Island. I took minimum wage work during the recession. I had closed my business after 23 years. While I was acknowledged as a high producer and a high earner at that company by my new boss, I still qualified for assistance and food stamps for my family. So, no, I couldn't live on minimum wage.
Tell us your story. You can call us at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can tweet us at The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Arkansas Economic Development Commission and the state committed to acting quickly and decisively on corporate interests. Learn more about how Arkansas works for businesses at arkansasedc.com. Want more information about the stories you hear on The Takeaway? Check out thetakeaway.org for more facts, figures, and news from guests and contributors and opinions from your fellow listeners. Leave us a note or comment on a story you heard, all at thetakeaway.org.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. For the last few months on this show, we've been running our series called Uncomfortable Truths, where we invited you, our listeners, to talk with someone in your life about race. Last week, we featured a conversation with Takeaway listener Rochelle Shimke and her brother, Garrett. Rochelle is white, and Garrett, who was adopted, is black.
I grew up happy because I wasn't looking for those kind of things. I wasn't thinking of myself as a victim. I wasn't looking to be mistreated, so therefore I wasn't, even if I was. So why can't that be more of the trend, as opposed to always going up and pointing fingers at people and just calling everybody in the world a racist for everything?
That conversation made us want to turn to Rebecca Carroll. She's editor of special projects at WNYC Radio, and she spends a lot of time talking to families and advising them on adoption and interracial adoption. Rebecca, like Garrett, is black and was also adopted by a white family, but had a very different experience than Garrett did. Rebecca joins me now. Rebecca Carroll, welcome.
Hi, Todd.
You heard Garrett there describing the nut of his experience. Your experience was very different.
Well, I mean, it's different in that I sort of doggedly pursued what it meant to have a kind of racial identity in an all-white environment. And I do want to also say that this notion that one has to go looking for racism in order for it to exist is both dangerous and false. I mean, it's false because the whole structural backdrop of this country is founded on racism. It's dangerous because it sort of lets lesser identifiable forms of racism other than violence go under the radar. And that's really my chief concern with interracial adoption, especially white parents of black children in super white environments, is that it's almost impossible to avoid internalizing that sort of white lens unless you have parents and people around you who can help you sort of get out of that thinking.
Now, this isn't abstract for you. You're a black woman. You grew up in New Hampshire. Talk about that and how that brought you to this place.
Well, I was adopted as an infant. My parents had two biological kids before they adopted me. They're 4 and 6 years older. And I was aware that I was Black. I was not aware of my race. So that is to say, I had brown skin. You know, I watched Electric Company. I saw Morgan Freeman play Easy Reader, who I sort of fantasized was my birth father, because I knew my parents were very open with me that I was adopted and that I had birth parents. But I didn't have any sort of tools of navigating what race meant and what racial identity meant. So when I first started to come into contact with incidents of racism, it didn't occur to me to talk with my parents about it, because there were no Black people in our lives. There was no social reference or cultural reference. So, you know, when I was in fifth grade, my teacher told me I was very pretty for a Black girl, which I knew it made me feel badly, but I didn't know really why it made me feel badly, and I didn't know what that meant. So I sort of had to find out how to process racism, which then led me to really take a deep dive into navigating what race meant.
Now that you're an adult, what do you feel like you missed growing up the way you did?
I really often mourn not having had Black people, Black family around me. The feeling that I have when I walk into a room full of Black folks is like nothing else. I feel lifted. I feel kinship. I feel joy. I feel seen. I wish that I had had this when I was coming up. It's like I remember the girl that I was. You know, there's this whole hashtag Black Girl Magic that's in the world now. And I just think I had Black Girl Magic. Like, I was a very kind of precocious kid, and I was very social, and I loved to dance and perform. Like, I was all of that. And if I had had that kind of support system, it would have saved my heart a little bit, because right at that age, when it was important, is when that my teacher said that to me. And then a series of things happened, right? My friend in high school's father forbid him to take me to the prom because I'm Black. I had a boss in high school in my after school job call me a lazy N-word because I refused to clean the bathroom after he used it. And I was a secretary. Like, that wasn't really even my job. Like, a series of things happened that really started to crush my soul a little bit. And I think had I had that kind of support to kind of buoy me, that would have been really good.
What did your mother say when you went home and said, "Mom, he won't go to the prom with me. His dad won't let him"?
Each of these incidents that happened, and I've talked with my mom about this, either I told them and their response was so unremarkable that I forget, or I did not tell them because it didn't occur to me to tell them. They were not thinking about me as their Black daughter. They just weren't at any point in time. And so for me to kind of say, well, this happened, they probably would have said, that sucks, you know, but without any kind of context, without any kind of cultural context.
So Rebecca, today your mother reads what you write. Let's assume she's listening to this right now about the shortcomings that you experienced in your interactions with her, and through no deficit of love, but what are your conversations with her like now?
So she was recently here, and she is truly one of my most favorite people, and so generous of spirit and loving, I want to say that. But so she visits me here. She's an artist, and so we often go to exhibits together. Recently, she came and we went to the Brooklyn Museum to see this exhibit about Black women artists called We Wanted a Revolution. After the exhibit, she said to me, this is amazing. I had no idea. And I said, I know. I know you had no idea. And that is really painful for me. And she said, okay, let's figure this out, you know. But she is deeply committed to whatever I send her way, of course, as it is for any mother to hear from your adult child or your child, this was painful for me and you could have helped it not be painful. But she faces it head on.
Have you talked to your brother and sister about this and your upbringing?
It's really hard to engage with them on this subject. And, you know, they're not bad people. They're just not curious about my experience, which has been very, very difficult to navigate. And as I get older, particularly as a mom, you know, I just feel less and less like pushing if they're not going to meet me somewhere. So it's, I think that they would say exactly what a lot of white parents and white siblings of adopted children would say, and that is, we love you like you're our sister, and that's all there is to it.
None of this really matters because you're just our sister. Why talk about it?
That's right. That's right. And, you know, they don't read my work. They don't really know what I do. So it makes it harder to maintain a relationship, quite frankly. Again, not because they're bad people, but because at a certain point, you have to see what's happening in the world around you.
So, Rebecca Carroll, how old is your son now?
He turns 12 in 2 weeks.
Oh, he's getting there. He's almost a teenager.
Yep, he sure is.
You think a lot, I'm sure, about what he'll be like when he's 21 mm-hmm. or 25, mm-hmm. and he'll be a biracial young black man in America.
Mm-hmm.
Who do you want him to be?
Oh, I want him to be himself. I want him to be his best and smartest and happiest self. And I want him to be certainly racially conscious, culturally fulfilled, and again, of the world.
Rebecca Carroll, thank you for being here. A pleasure as always.
Thanks, Todd.
Rebecca Carroll is editor of special projects at WNYC Radio. Well, that's all for us today. Thank you so much for listening. And as always, we want to hear from you. Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can tweet us at The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples. Staples offers copy and print services for businesses, including color copies, presentations, and promotional products. More at Staples stores or at staples.com. Staples, it's pro time.
PRI, Public Radio International.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.